Hey friends, welcome to the Book Spider podcast, which offers listeners insightful literary analysis and therefore unlimited fun. The hosts of this program are as follows: Chris Malmberg, Hans Berger, and myself, Patrick Barney. During this episode, we'll be discussing Stanisław Lem's His Master's Voice, a science fiction novel that, like Carl Sagan's Contact, features a group of scientists trying to decode an extraterrestrial message. Unlike Contact, however, His Master's Voice offers a skeptical vision. The novel takes the form of a memoir written by one of the researchers assigned to decode the message. This researcher is named Peter Hogarth, a statistician whose main positive contribution to the project, codenamed His Master's Voice by the Pentagon, or HMV for short, is a discovery that the circularity of the extraterrestrial message may hint at its larger meaning. Otherwise, though, he represents what project leaders call the opposition, a subgroup within the HMV project that believes a variety of factors, linguistic, technological, and scientific, will make decoding the message impossible. In fact, Hogarth has undertaken his memoir to argue this very idea, that the project was ultimately a failure, and he opines that no other book written about HMV has been willing to admit this fact. Hogarth's memoir describes the main discoveries of the project. One is the creation of two forms of a substance with strange properties, a gelatinous blob called frog's eggs, and a hunk of something that looks like red meat called Lord of the Flies. Another discovery is called TX, for tele-explosion, a power that could enable the possessor of frog's eggs to teleport an atomic blast anywhere they wanted at light speed. However, no one knows if they've created frog's eggs because the extraterrestrial message contains the instructions for doing so, or because project scientists have mistranslated or even read into the message. Eventually, after a shakeup within the project, new scientists with new ideas join the research. The main thrust of this group of thinkers is that the message isn't a message at all, but a kind of accidental transmission from a dead anti-world. The transmission itself has led to the replication or recreation of the anti-world in their universe. At this point, Hogarth and the colleagues he's become acquainted with on the project begin to fade out, returning to their different lives outside the project. Hogarth ends his memoir by noting that the anti-world hypothesis is reasonable, that he couldn't believe he didn't think of it himself, but he simply cannot let go of the idea that the message had a sender and that this sender had designed the message in such a way that it would be impossible for civilizations without the proper level of societal development to decode it. He leaves with a note of pessimism, comparing the human race to snails. Anybody want to add anything before we get into the thick of the discussion?
Nope.
Okay. So the first thing I want to talk about is the structure of the novel. Maybe structure is not quite the right word, but in any case, I find it very, very satisfying how the elements of this novel do seem to be, they seem like they could fit into a blockbuster novel or some kind of gritty sci-fi thriller with a lot of major developments. So, you know, discovering an extraterrestrial message, that's big news. You know, creating weird things from the message. And then these weird substances may be able to be used as a weapon. Then there's the shakeup in the project where we discover that there's another project with scientists controlled by the military. But then it turns out that, you know, the substance that they've created can't actually be used for a weapon, and the military loyalists are folded into the larger group, and then the group kind of just keeps on thinking and going on and doing the business of decoding the message. So there's all these kind of major plot points that could have fueled more of a thriller type novel, but really these elements aren't used for thrills. They're really just the scaffolding on which, you know, the scaffolding that Lem uses for essentially essays in the philosophy of science, really. So I really dig this. Like it you know, I find it a deeply satisfying novel for this fact. I think both the philosophy of science stuff is interesting, and I also find that the fact that he uses this structure, this thrill-like structure, so to speak, to produce these essays in the philosophy of science, I find that interesting. So did you like this structure? Was it enough for you? Did you need more? You know, what were your thoughts on this kind of technique?
I liked it a lot. I mean, I don't know that I understood on a first read everything that's here, right? And it seems really like a novel that would lend itself particularly well to a second reading, going through it with a better sense of what the plot is and who the characters are, and less focusing a bit less on the kind of minute to minute suspense of it, because there is a certain aspect of suspense, right? A certain aspect of curiosity, focusing less on that and really kind of being able to, having that part internalized, being able to think more about and focus more on the what you called the aspect where it discusses the philosophy of science, right? But I did find it interesting and satisfying and enjoyable, even though I don't necessarily know how much of the philosophical parts of it I retained or on a first read could really talk about in depth, I think. I mean, like, right, looking through some of the questions that you sent, like you mentioned that on a second read, I'm giving away a later question, but it ties to the point that I'm making here, right? Like, you talked about on a second read being much clearer with the purpose of the prologue. And I think there's a lot of it that would probably open itself a lot more on a second read. So yeah, I'm a little bit jealous of your position there, right?
But
I did find it both, I mean, the two main threads of this, the kind of sci-fi question, right? The sci-fi suspense aspect and the way that it functions as a novel of ideas. I found both of those interesting and satisfying. I have to admit that the particular plot point that you called out where, I mean, the main character is one of the folks, the narrator is one of the folks who figures out the soonest that the one aspect of the signal allows you to basically teleport a nuclear explosion, right?
Right.
It's essentially like a undefeatable, limitless weapon. He's one of the first people to figure that out and, you know, kind of faces the question, faces a hard question about what to do about that. And then there's kind of an odd fizzling where, oh, actually, it just turns out that's not a problem. And I think that particular moment, I wouldn't call it a flaw necessarily, but that particular moment was especially like the way that's kind of the main or one of the main sources of tension in the novel, right? It's like the dilemma of how they're going to handle that discovery.
Right.
And then to see it just kind of basically in a way deus ex machina out, that was one part where that was maybe the only part where I sort of bristled a bit at maybe bristled is too strong a word, but like the part of me, you know, like as somebody who's like trained on the conventions of fiction, you have a way of editing everything that you read, right? You're evaluating it compared to what you know are the conventions of how you're supposed to write fiction. And that was one moment where I went, wait a minute, this is like the main source of tension and the main thing that's really kind of calling the narrator to do something, and you're just kind of like shrugging it into resolution. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was accidental, right? Like,
right.
I don't know if it was actually meant as metafictional, but I mean, I think that like it, there's an interesting clash there between, in that particular moment, there's kind of a clash between the incentives of the sci-fi suspense novel and the incentives of the novel of ideas.
Right.
And you can see like the priorities of the novel of ideas winning out there. And that was, I think that's really, it was pretty clear what it was doing up until that point, but when that happens, it really became clear what it was doing. And so I think it's interesting that you called that out in the question.
Right.
But I did enjoy it, and I liked it a lot. And I mean, the philosophical ideas are very engaging, and the when it is kind of going into, like, at just at the level of, oh, this is a weird thing to happen. Oh, this is a weird thing to happen. Oh, I wasn't expecting that. Like, that's, it is very surprising and creative in that way as well.
Yeah, and I think of it some sort of as a vibe, or I'll say, isn't this kind of a trope or even kind of a genre where some large bureaucratic enterprise is confronted with some kind of problem and opportunity, and then within that enterprise you have this sense of things like not progressing or confusion about whether they're progressing or not. And, you know, a kind of, I think of Catch-22 or what I believe I understood of Gravity's Rainbow. But isn't there kind of a style of storytelling where like you have this kind of melange of conspiracy theory and fecklessness or apparent fecklessness, or like, you know, like uncertainty about like whether things are progressing or not progressing or the purpose of things, and or is it like, does that make sense? Like it feels like that's like a kind of a story, and I think of it like almost like a vibe that's in his master's voice.
Well, there's definitely the trope of like the first contract trope, right, in sci-fi, and
which usually is like, you know, it's that usually progresses into some kind of, you know, confrontation between like,
right,
the scientists and the government, or like the humans and the aliens, or the good humans and the bad humans, or,
right, exactly,
you know, some, you know, like, and it feels like this is, like you said, like this is skeptical about like our own capability of actually understanding a truly alien language or message, or even distinguishing whether it's a message at all.
Right.
And I don't know, it reminded me of, it feels like military fiction, like kind of like,
sure,
satirical military fiction is sort of the thing that I'm thinking of, where like you're stuck in this sort of larger institution of war, and it feels like a kind of mindless joke. And,
right,
and that's what this book reminded me of.
And like, because it's a satire, that's one of the things why I was more okay with, like Hans, you said that this main tension of the novel, like, what's the deal with this teleporting atomic blast thing? And because it's a satire, because it's a critique of either military fiction or the first contact sci-fi trope, or whatever the scope of its satire is, because I knew that from the start, I felt like it was fine that it's like, this is a satire. I know we're not going to go into the traditional places, so I'm okay with this tension fizzling out. I'm okay with, you know, there's not a huge conflict in the end between disparate forces. You know, like the people who think one thing just kind of gradually leave the project, and people who think new and different things come in and take it over. So I definitely, I definitely see what you're saying, Chris, and I think that there is an element of that in here.
Yeah, and I happen to enjoy those types of stories. I think that they do kind of feel like they circle over the same ground often, over and over and over again, but kind of like, and I felt that in this book too. I felt like we kind of treaded in different ways this idea of the inaccessibility of the totally alien other. And I think the really interesting thing that I hope we talk about is the role of science, or maybe more specifically math, as something that is like evacuated of culturation or cultural symbology. And so it becomes something that can traverse that bridge, or can bridge between two unlike beings, two unlike speakers. But then because it lacks the symbology of culture, it doesn't actually communicate any, or potentially doesn't communicate anything at all. I think that's fascinating.
Well, yeah, the Hogarth brings that up when he's meeting with the senator, right? Like, math is a non-cultural language, which kind of enables you to communicate, but because it's non-cultural, it means that you can't. Right?
Yes. I felt like that. I feel like that was, it was said there. I think it was explored in kind of in different way. I think that question was explored in several different ways. And I think that that's kind of what, you know, this type of book of ideas, you know, does, is it sort of has like some locus, or locuses, is that plural for locus?
Loci? I don't know.
That's terrible. But they have kind of a central sort of like idea that they're untangling, and they sort of circle them in you know, kind of, you know, different scenes. And no, I was thinking of the senator's conversation, but I was also thinking of just the foreword and the, you know, his story about why he gravitated to math, you know, kind of escaping his own, you know, feelings about his mother's death and stuff like that. And it kind of feels like there's a larger sort of thing at the center there that I did enjoy interrogating. I did kind of feel like sometimes like an essay might be a little bit more succinct
than
this book, though.
Yeah, definitely. You know, an essay explaining the central idea or the central thesis that, you know, like we may be unable to communicate with aliens no matter what. You know, that would definitely be more succinct. Which makes you think, are there any benefits to going, doing it this way? You know, is there a benefit to writing a novel that's very essayistic and idea based over just writing an essay itself?
I think that ideas are, ideas always come across better if you have concrete examples, right? Mm-hmm. If you're trying to explain a principle to somebody, or if you're trying to play out how a particular thing might function in the world. It's just a lot easier to have, like, the human brain, I think, latches itself onto narrative better than it does to abstraction, right? So, you know, if you have, and I mean, I don't know that I'm talking specifically about His Master's Voice here so much as just generally the function of the novel of ideas and the advantage of a novel over an essay. But I think it intrinsically makes ideas more approachable if you have scenarios in which they are being illustrated. And that's really the virtue of the novel of ideas, I think, is to you make the idea more approachable by illustrating it with a narrative manner. The trick, of course, is to get the ratio correct of the ideas and the illustration, mm-hmm. right? Because, I mean, you know, the kind of, you, if you think about, I don't know, like the DeLillo novels from the 70s and 80s, right? Like the characters will sit around and discourse about a particular idea, and then narrative will happen that illustrates that idea in action, right? And the trick, I think, is making that ratio work. And I can imagine some readers feeling like the ratio here is maybe too skewed toward philosophical analysis and discourse, right? Because it, you know, if you allow too much of that to kind of creep over the balance of the novel, then at some point you kind of do sort of go, oh, why am I not just reading an essay? It does, I mean, I think like the plot here does offer some advantage in that there are, I think, plausible circumstantial reasons for these people to be talking about these ideas, right? Like, mm-hmm. they're in a position where it makes a lot of sense for them to actually be really kind of trying to interrogate the limits of knowledge and science, more so than some novels where, you know, people just have a couple beers and shoot the shit about philosophy.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of the limits of science, I'm interested in knowing how far we think the satire of this novel goes. You know, what is included within its satirical scope? And the reason I ask this is because, you know, reading a lot, I've read a lot of Lim's work, a lot of his novels kind of deal with this same idea in different ways. So, you know, Solaris isn't a first contact novel because, you know, the living planet has been around for a century or so. So it's not exactly first contact. But, you know, it's the same kind of like, you know, how can we communicate with this thing when we don't even understand even the basics? Then he has another novel, Fiasco, which is about a spaceship traveling to another planet that may or may not be a violent aggressor. And, you know, on their way there, they're trying to figure out if transmissions from the planet should be interpreted as acts of aggression or not. He's written a lot of short stories that are actually more just funny sci-fi ideas. Like he's got one series of stories about these two robot adventurer friends who are just idiots and get into a lot of trouble that are hilarious, but don't really go into these same ideas. So, you know, what do we think? Like, how far are we going? How far is this novel going in trying to satirize science or bureaucracy or whatever it is?
I have to admit that I struggled a lot with that question.
Mm-hmm.
I think partly because This is a very interesting novel to read. I mean, how old is this? 67, I think it was originally.
Yeah, translated into English in 83.
Right, right. But I mean, it's written from the perspective. I mean, for fuck's sake, it predates the moon landing, right?
Right.
And it's
if you believe in the moon landing.
Right.
Well, sure. It predates the official date of the moon landing.
Right.
So it's very, I think there's an extra level of complexity to reading it because I was often, and I'm not the most scientifically literate or informed person, right? But it's like, as you read it, you invariably wonder, like, I mean, presumably the state of knowledge in these disciplines has advanced since 1967.
Right? Sure.
And so it's not just that it's a satire of a particular branch of science. It's a satire of a particular branch of science as it existed 70 years ago, right? Give or take. And so there are certain places that, you have moments that feel, you have moments that ring very true. And then you have moments that you think, wait, would this, if I were more familiar with the state of science in 2024, would this seem odd or dated? So I have to admit that because of that temporal gap, I struggled a bit with understanding the satire, honestly.
Sure. Yeah,
the philosophical aspects, the narrative aspects, I liked a lot. The extent to which it's a distinct comment on the state of the world in its time, I was less sure about. Mm. And so I don't know that I can necessarily answer that question with really any certainty at all, honestly.
I was thinking about it a little bit. I think that, like, there's specific things about the, I think less about scientific community. I think more about the academic community, which is maybe not exactly the same thing, but like
close
this. Yeah. So the tribalism between the so-called elves and the so-called dwarves,
right,
or scientists who are engaged in more humanities style stuff, more soft, quote unquote. And then, hard sciences like math, like Hogarth, statistics, and the kind of defensiveness over the lenses, how sacrosanct the lenses each one has developed to apply to view the world through, and sort of understand, much less solve the problems that they're trying to solve. So like Hogarth talks about applying pure mathematical solutions to figuring out like why people have neuroses, and basically saying like it's just a natural, there is no sort of like deeper meaning, there's nothing there,
right?
He
comes up with a logical proof about the distribution of neuroses in the human population.
Yeah. And this actually reminds me of something that I've learned about recently. I think it's called emergence. It's a concept in science that is kind of about that line. So like it's sort of one of the distinguishing, trenches in the trench warfare between deterministic people who believe in determinism and people who don't, in the scientific community. But basically the idea is that things like culture may emerge from, or things like the Mona Lisa may emerge from the trajectory and speed and mass of atoms,
right?
Things like that. But if you studied the trajectory, speed, and mass of atoms, they would not explain anything about the Mona Lisa, right? So like there's this thing, this kind of threshold beyond which, math no longer explains, at least on the level or in the, down the lines of inquiry that like we're actually interested in as humans. Like like this the science doesn't explain any of that.
Right.
And that reminded me a lot of like this sort of thing that Hogarth is, you know, thinking about, which is like the impossibility of communication and all the tools that we use to kind of like step outside of ourselves, kind of also like kind of fuck with, you know, the whole process of communication. But that tribalism in the scientific community, the ways in which there's this tension between the scientific community and military interests, kind of like at the end we get this anti whatever, this idea, like different people come,
the anti-world.
Yeah, and I don't remember who. It's the thing about this novel. There's all these different people too.
Yeah.
There's not really a story to kind of make sense of them. Right. But someone gives a speech about the anti-world theory, right. And I don't understand that shit. But it seemed like a parody of like there's even a line in there like, and I'm generalizing. He was far more detailed, and I didn't understand like the general like summary of what this person said. And
right.
And the kind of navel gazing, kind of like vernacular, the really complex, like, so it, to me, like it really gelled with a parody, and it could be like kind of timeless, honestly, of academia,
right?
But that's what I'm familiar with, you know, and I think that it is adjacent to the scientific community,
yeah,
enough that kind of rang true, and it felt like it was kind of making fun of all of it. But like Hans, I think that I'm missing some details that would come with a second read through.
And I definitely agree with that assessment. I think that like drawing the analogy of academia is pretty spot on. It feels very much like, you know, Lim is satirizing these, you know, people, you know, defending their disciplines and kind of getting into these onanistic lines of thought and all of this. So I definitely agree with all that. I wonder, you know, I wonder specifically if the novel is ultimately anti-realist about science. Like, and the reason I wonder that is because, like I mentioned in my question, you know, Lim himself completed coursework for a medical degree. He ultimately didn't become a doctor. I think I read in an interview because he couldn't stand the sight of blood. Which, how do you even get through a medical degree without dealing with blood? I would think that you would have to do that, you know, even when he was in school, you know, in the 40s or 50s, whenever that was. You know, presumably you have to have realism about science to conduct medicine. Right, to practice medicine. So is this, you know, is this novel a total rejection of realism about science, or is there some limit to that rejection? Do we have any thoughts on that, or is that too just we don't know?
I don't think that. So I think that like Hogarth, because I have a different question to kind of like maybe come back to, and mm-hmm. I'll just say it now because, you know, earlier you and Hans were talking about like why make this into a book and why have a kind of, you know, point of view character like Hogarth. And my instinct is to wonder like what Hogarth's character is as a kind of, you know, fallible prism through through which to view this. So like, why have a viewpoint character? Because it makes you question that viewpoint character. But I don't know. I don't know enough. I really came out of this and I have no, I have zero confidence doing that. So like, so if you just sort of take Hogarth at his word, I don't think that Hogarth is anti-realist.
Right. No.
I think what he's doing is he's drawing lines beyond which we're not at this point capable with science.
Okay.
So science is within bounds, science is realistic. But again, like, I wonder if there's something to this novel that I'm supposed to be questioning because it's coming to me from a character who, you know, is admitting to the, you know, basically writing this, you know, about like our own fallibility. So I wonder how his own, especially since it feels like I'm supposed to a little bit, because like he's kind of, there's a kind of confirmation bias thing with him. He's really like, he's very invested in this interpretation of events, which is not a very scientific, you know, you're supposed to let the evidence speak for itself, not, you know, have a conviction about what evidence is going to say and then be like, see, I fucking told you, it's all meaningless. But, you know, that's, so all that to say, I don't think of it as anti-realist. But I'm not sure if I'm missing stuff.
There's a passage that I remember finding very amusing, and I found this just by searching for a keyword in my Kindle copy, so I'm not going to be able to give you a real clear context for it, right? But he says to observe how, and this is just like the stream of thought of Hogarth, if I remember right, to observe how pure thought or lofty detachment sweats, blinks, digs in its ear, how it manages, with varying success, its own machinery, which, supporting the soul, so often gets in the soul's way. This has always been for me an iconoclastic treat, malicious through and through. I remember how once I was being driven by a famous philosopher who admitted to solipsism, and he got a flat tire. Interrupting his discourse on the phantasmagoria of illusion, which is all existence, he set about, in the most ordinary way, jacking up the car and hauling out the spare. Using the illusion of a wrench, he removed one by one the non-existent nuts, then looked with despair at his hands covered with grease, the grease no more substance than a dream, according to his doctrine, but somehow that did not enter his head. Obviously, you know, Hogarth there is kind of taking aim at more abstract philosophy, but I wonder if there's not kind of a principle there that you can apply to some of these questions about the limits of science, right? It's like science in extreme positions, in extreme cases, like the one described in the novel, there are certainly very significant limits to what science can achieve and what it can know, and to the ways in which subjectivity is going to distort and warp our experience and our quest for knowledge, right? At the same time, science, it remains very good at jacking up the car and taking off the lug nuts, right? And I think you kind of, you can spend a lot of time kind of using these very arcane philosophical processes to undermine the foundations of all human knowledge. But at some point, they're still pretty severe mechanical processes that we can control with knowledge and science, right? It's like you can invalidate it in an abstract way, but that does not invalidate the ways in which it is, in fact, quite useful as a tool. It's like there was something that we read in our first year of grad school that I found very satisfying about, like, a bunch of postmodern philosophers on an airplane to a conference, right? And they're all sitting there babbling about like different ways of knowing and the unknowability of reality and nothing existing outside of subjectivity and kind of the illusions of the scientific, the illusions of scientific of certainty. And then, you know, well, but something's keeping the airplane up.
Right.
And I mean, I think like I'm having trouble kind of making this a neat, putting this neatly into a larger point about where the novel falls. But I think that that vignette, you can kind of take that and apply it to a lot of, it's not that science is impotent or powerless or that it doesn't achieve some kind of very powerful truth, right? But that also doesn't mean that there aren't limits to it as well. And that's really kind of the ultimate mystery in a way of the philosophy of the novel, right? It's like the, how do you reconcile those two understandings?
That makes a lot of sense to me, because there, we mentioned earlier, like, neuroses, the distribution of neuroses. And I believe I remember when Hogarth introduces this idea, he points out that he has proven logically how, I forget what he says he proves, but he, something about algedonic response and how algedonic control is portioned out among a population. And he says, I think he says it follows a bell curve or something like that, you know. So on either extreme, you have less algedonic control and more algedonic control, but most people fall in the middle. And but what I'm getting at is that he says he's proven this idea logically, infallibly. So here's an example of something that rationality can do, but then when we, it seems like everybody ignores this, nobody likes this, they think it's interesting, but the very fact that it's not interpretable, that it can't be talked about more deeply, is what seems to doom the idea to the dusty corners of scientific history, so to speak, right? Like, the fact that it doesn't leave room for scientists to kind of muck about is what keeps it from being a really interesting discovery. Does everybody remember that? Like, remember that idea?
Yeah, I think it's maybe mirrored when he proves that the signal is closes itself,
right?
And isn't open ended. So, so far as I understand, any kind of like polyhedron or structure, and I'm definitely struggling to describe this because I struggled to understand it. But basically, it is not open. It's closed. And that, you know, if it was random, more often it would be far more likely to end open than it would be to end closed. And that's probably the best I'm going to do. But basically, he proves that. But he says immediately, I don't have any capability to see what to say why it's closed, you know, or what that means. And so it seems like sort of like the proof for the random bell curve of neuroses in humans, and that those neuroses having nothing to do with the lines of inquiry that psychologists and theologists are, you know, following in their own fields. His proof of the circularity and closed nature of the signal is interesting, but also kind of like it's not apparently useful.
Right.
And that seems to be a pattern with him.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Interesting. I like that. I do think that is a good parallel. The circularity of the message doesn't seem to be that useful, even though it's proven logically, just like, you know, the neuroses distribution is proven logically, but like, hey, you know, we can't invent Freudian pansexuality based on this distribution, so it's not that great, right? Which I think is hilarious. I actually think this novel is effing hilarious. It's so heady that maybe it doesn't register, but I like that passage that you read, Hans. I found amusing. There's a lot of this I find amusing, actually.
Yeah. Much of it is very dry, but I actually also I didn't mark as many of them as I wish, but there are just a lot of the cleverest little asides
that are
so witty in such a dry way.
Yeah.
And I don't have any other examples to present, unfortunately. But
in contrast, though, there's one point in the novel that reaches like a poignancy that, like, in a novel that's so idea heavy, which I love, by the way, but in a novel that's so idea heavy and so cerebral, there aren't a lot of moments where like it really kind of gut punches you. But one of them is when Rappaport tells the story of surviving a Nazi death squad. So Rappaport is one of the other researchers on the project that Hogarth seems to befriend, and Rappaport tells him about being lined up by the members of a Nazi death squad, and the commander of the death squad says, "Look, I need one volunteer." And so the implication is that this volunteer will be executed and everyone else in the line will go free, right?
This is after they've already executed a bunch of people too.
Right. So this is what they think. And so the person who volunteers will kind of be a sacrifice, and, you know, but someone has to do it, because then if nobody does, then someone then they all die. So eventually one person does volunteer. The members of the death squad take this volunteer around the corner, and, you know, the Jews that have been lined up hear gunshots. But then a second later, the volunteer comes back alive, and they realize, they weren't going to kill him. They were going to have him kill someone else. So, and then I forget if it's Hogarth who wonders this and Rappaport answers him, or if it's like somebody wondering it within Rappaport's anecdote, but basically
Rappaport's testing him. Rappaport asks, like, why do you think?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Didn't explain this.
And right.
Hogarth's answer is that he's malicious. But,
right.
But Rappaport then says what I think what you're going to say.
Right, which is that the commander doesn't say anything because the commander is the only person within the death squad who is actually at one with his logical beliefs. And his beliefs are that Jews are inhuman and that you can't talk to them, that you can't have a conversation with something inhuman, so you can't explain anything to them, right? And I'm wondering, you know, and this is in contrast to the other members of the Death Squad who Rappaport says have to brutalize their victims to kind of gear themselves up for violence, because in brutalizing them, in dehumanizing them, they can let go of seeing them as humans. Like if their victims have bloody faces or broken body parts, things like that, then it's easier to think that this victim is not a human being. So I'm wondering what does this anecdote tell us about the larger purpose of the novel? You know, why is it there? What is it? What purpose does it serve, do we think?
I think it's, first of all, I thought it was a really, like, awesome little vignette.
Yeah, it really is. Really haunting.
Really haunting. And it feels to me, my instinct is that it's saying something about how dangerous it is to not empathize, to allow yourself a philosophy that divorces yourself from the concerns of others and allows you to view them as not entities, you know, I guess like humans in this case,
right.
But like given that the subject of the novel is also potentially, you know, about aliens, but sapient, self-deterministic beings who deserve respect, and in the mode of thought that commander is, and Rappaport's very interesting. Rappaport talks about him as like an ascended being, like basically he has evolved to a higher plane of understanding of this situation than his Death Squad, and sounds incredibly grotesque to me, and it feels like my instinct is that, you know, an incredibly dangerous thing,
right,
that the novel is talking about there.
Like, there is something astounding about a person who can unite himself so completely with his beliefs that he wouldn't even think to explain himself to another being because he doesn't think those beings are capable of understanding explanations. That is astounding. And so saying like saying it's an evolution kind of makes sense, but it's also a horrifying, terrifying devolution, right? Where the ascent to be more than human makes you less than human, right? Or am I just trying to be poetic? Yeah, am I just trying to be poetic about it, though?
I like that because I think that I don't know that it's entirely that pat, but it feels like a lot of the intellectual aspiration that is captured in this novel either is a parody of, is some kind of parody, or is just evacuated of broader meaning, even if it's intellectually satisfying.
Right.
So I think that there's maybe something there.
Is it something about certainty, the perils of certainty? Something about letting go of the possibility of wrongness or letting go of intellectual humility?
I definitely see that. Absolutely. Sure. 100%.
I mean, that also seems kind of pat, and I don't know if I can extend it in a more nuanced way. I don't know if I can break it. I don't know if I can develop it to in the way that it deserves, but that seems significant to me.
Well, that itself kind of mirrors what we were talking about with the neurosis distribution and the circularity of the message, in that earlier we talked about it as if, like, the fact that these ideas, the distribution of neuroses, it's not useful, so other people aren't that interested in it. But also, they are examples of being absolutely certain, right? Of, like, a logical proof. So there's also some, seems like there's some problem there if, like, we reach logical certainty and we're no longer open to any counter evidence or counterpoints. That's a problem as well. Okay, so let's wrap things up. But one last question that I want to get out of what I want to hear from you guys. The novel ends on a note of pessimism, right? It seems to be fairly, Hogarth is pessimistic about human intellectual endeavors, kind of comparing human beings to snails, which, you know, assuming we leave aside that they're, like, short and slimy and slow, maybe it's pessimistic in that, like, you can't think of anything as kind of unintellectual as a snail, right? So how do you react to this pessimism? Do we think that this is, like, is this satisfying as an ending? Are we meant to kind of identify ourselves with this pessimism? What do you think?
I'm feeling pretty strongly right now that's, you know, given what we talked about with Rappaport, not good. I don't know. So, like, back to the prologue, it feels like, you know, it feels like there's another thing that sort of sticks out for me in terms of, like an emotionally true and strange thing, you know, that's it. You know, Rappaport's story about the Nazi death squad is one, but the Hogarth's reaction to his mother's sickness and then death, where Hogarth is jumping up and down on his bed with glee because his mother is dying, and then confronted with her death, he, like, laughs and is he's distraught, but he sort of seems to indicate, or at least, like, in retrospect, like, diagnose himself as sort of running to math as a way of distancing himself from that, like, weird, very uncomfortable experience. And, you know, I don't know, I definitely need to read this book again, but it feels like being pessimistic about this, it'd be very easy to be pessimistic about this, you know, mm-hmm. experience. You know, I think that's not, you know, I don't think that in the end, aspiring to understand something that is not understandable is kind of heroic, and or it can be. It can be seen as such, even if, like, you know, a lot of the beats,
Sisyphean, are, maybe,
you know. Yeah, and a lot of the, you know, details are, you know, silly or don't reflect well on us, but, like, ultimately, you know, that's who we are, you know, and or at least that's what, you know, that's what the scientific community is. And so I don't know. It's a very, I didn't have that feeling until you asked that question. So maybe on reflection, I should have shut up and not said anything, because it's just sort of a flash of conviction that it's not, that there is something very humanistic in this book, some humanistic impulse that is a little bit occluded by a lot of the, by all of the, I don't know. It's a little bit occluded, but I think it's there, and I think that it's not not good to end with that conviction that we're nothing but snails.
Mm. Anything to add, Hans, before we wrap up?
That sounds about right.
Okay.
I really, really enjoyed this, and I'm having trouble. I want to come back. We never do follow-up episodes. Can we, like, read this again in, like, 6 months?
Sure.
I would
do, like,
that.
A Solaris Revisited. Not Solaris. His Master's Voice Revisited, rather.
Yeah, we can do that. That's a new like idea that we haven't done before. There's nothing wrong with that.
This and Checkout 19.
Oh no!
I want to do revisits.
No,
on both of those.
No, you guys can do that.
Well,
no, Checkout 19 for you, Chris.
I would do no. Check it, it. I remember being confounded by Checkout 19, but it was short. Like, I could listen to it in less than a shift at work. So.
That's a fascinating question of which ones would you want to go back to. I would go back to the Garden of Seven Twilights.
I that definitely deserves a read through. It's so hefty though. So hefty.
Yeah.
It's a beast. Checkout 19, fine. If you want to do it, I'll do it.
Well, you know, down the road if
we can bear it in mind too.
Yeah. If somebody remembers it or thinks about it. Hey everyone, this is Patrick Barney coming to you after the initial recording of the His Master's Voice podcast to let you know that we had a technical oopsie. Basically, what happened was we recorded the podcast after His Master's Voice, covering a book that Chris picked. Unfortunately, due to some problems with the hardware on which that podcast was recorded, we're unable to share it with you. So the next podcast that will be shared will cover The Last Man by Mary Shelley. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Book Spider. We covered His Master's Voice. I hope you found our discussion enlightening and entertaining. Peace out. Until next time.